This podcast is an unedited excerpt from a live MCLE webcast. See the episode notes for details about the speakers and links to the program's full video and audio recording. Get access to everything MCLE offers for one low subscription fee with the MCLE Online Pass. Try it for free for a month. Go to www.mcle.org/onlinepass. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, see the MCLE website.
And, you know, teeing off on Golakian, I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Jim and Amy, but my recollection about that case is that the facts presented a number of the thorny issues that come up in an investigation. So I think the complainant had raised the issues, the plaintiff had raised the issues on her way out the door or after she had already been notified of her termination. They made a decision not to go back to her just because she had been terminated to get additional information. They had not, as Amy said, interviewed the colleagues in her department, maybe thinking bygones, she's gone, the issue is over. But of course, when it comes to harassment, the issue is not just about the plaintiff, right? So even if she had said, I don't want you to do an investigation, the information at that time was enough to make them or should have made them go, we got to look into this and we got to look into it because it may not be limited to what happened to this individual who's no longer employed here, right? And so it raises those issues of, wait a second, are the people who are making these decisions, what kind of investigation to do, are they the right people to do the investigation and make those calls? And I think that brings us to where we are now in our presentation, which is, okay, so we know we've got to look into a situation. We have, for lack of a better word, enough information that makes us go, what's going on? And we've decided we need to do an investigation. So who's going to do it? And the universe of options typically include sort of the somebody in human resources and an employee relations position, an HR business partner. And investigations are only a part of, typically in many organizations, a part of what they do. They spend the rest of their time advising and helping their managers navigate what to do from a human resources perspective, right? So it's human resources professionals, sometimes it's legal professionals, sometimes it's internal people in compliance, sometimes it's in-house counsel, sometimes it's outside counsel. And so in assessing who should conduct the investigation, a number of factors, we have listed here pros and cons. I think it's more an assessment of what's at issue, and who's best positioned to conduct the investigation. Now, the considerations that go into that are what's being alleged, who's alleging it, and about whom. Because if it's a very senior person who's the allegations are against, allegations of discrimination, say, or harassment, is somebody, everybody might report to them in some way, shape, or form. And is that time to go outside and say, hey, we need to get somebody like an Amy Serino to come in and do the investigation? Or is human resources able to conduct an investigation and get at the issues? And is that investigation going to be objective, right? Highly sensitive topics often, sometimes they require particular expertise Right. So maybe if an issue, and I know our focus today is on harassment, discrimination, retaliation claims, but if an issue involves some kind of financial fraud, there might be a need to call in somebody who has expertise in that area. And another really practical issue on who is doing the investigation is that oftentimes the timeliness of the investigation is absolutely critical. If our obligation is to take prompt remedial action, that means we can't wait until so and so comes back from vacation to start the investigation because that might not be quick enough. So oftentimes it's an issue of who can get to doing a thorough investigation, who has the time in their schedule to do it. And oftentimes the situations that employers are investigating require somebody to drop everything and turn their attention to getting at sort of the bottom of it. And if the goal of an investigation is to figure out what happened, as it often is, right? Like that's the goal. We want to be able, somebody who's doing the investigation at the end of the day has to be able to picture the facts like a movie in their mind. I always say, be able to tell the story like you were telling it at your dinner table. And if people have a lot of questions, those questions need to be answered. And that oftentimes requires a lot of time. And so, as a practical matter, it often comes down to how much time do people have to conduct, to vote. And then, like in the Galakian case, oftentimes issues rise and fall. And the outcomes rise and fall on the investigation. And if you're having somebody who's never conducted an investigation before or has very little investigation experience or training conduct the investigation, that's a lot of responsibility to put on one or two people who may not have the expertise that's and experience that's required to do the investigation. And I know that people here in the audience likely conduct investigations and also advise with respect to investigations. And in either role, kind of thinking about these issues, who's the right person to conduct the investigation is a threshold inquiry that should be addressed. And did I miss something, Jim or Amy, on the conflict of interest? I think conflicts of interest will arise if, you know, if somebody is too close to a situation or reports to people involved.
Sometimes things are so sensitive that you may have better luck with an outsider coming in because they don't want to be looking at the same person in the hallway who they've just told about something really traumatic or, you know, personal. And so that might be a good reason to bring in an outsider so that there can be a little more candor.
And then the other thing to think about is what is the investigator's role? What is the investigator being engaged to do? So it might be just to go out and figure out what happened, fact-finding only. Often, when attorneys are asked to conduct an investigation, it's for the purpose of providing legal advice and may be subject to the attorney-client privilege. And that is something, a threshold issue to consider. And oftentimes, people either assume something is not protected by the attorney-client privilege or they assume something is protected by the attorney-client privilege. And so it's really important to think about what's the purpose of this engagement? Is the goal to have this investigation protected by the attorney-client privilege? If so, have we taken the steps necessary to ensure that communications with counsel are subject to the attorney-client privilege? And that Jim's going to talk about an important case that came down in Massachusetts recently, the SJC case.
Is that my prompt?
That's your prompt.
Okay. So the decisions about whether to use an inside or an outside investigator, as well as defining the investigator's role, are important. for this other reason that Samia surfaced, which is the application of the attorney-client privilege or the work product doctrine to the investigation or to the product of the investigation or both, or to the materials that are gathered as part of the investigation. And Samia is absolutely right. It's not cut and dried. You can't assume either one extreme or the other. It may often be that some parts of the investigation are privileged, some parts are subject to the work product doctrine, some are subject to the work product doctrine, but they still can be released if you can show undue hardship, and so on. So it's a nuanced and important thing to item to think about. And it will also be a fodder for disputes during discovery and litigation as to whether or not the parties get access to the report or to the work that went into creating the report. So the first question to answer is, does any kind of privilege apply to the investigation? And as we've said, the work product doctrine and attorney-client privilege are not blanket protections for every thought or act of an attorney. And even if an attorney is involved in the investigation, doesn't mean you're off the hook. As the SJC said in the Attorney General versus Facebook decision, which, by the way, I think everybody needs to read as a it's really kind of a beautiful primer on this whole topic and will take you through all of the issues that I'm about to talk about. So if you want to just tune out and read that, you can do that, but obviously I'm much more interesting to listen to. But as the SJC said, simply funneling an organization's investigation through outside counsel does not bring with it the protection of the work product doctrine. And the same would be true of the attorney-client doctrine. So privilege. So what is the purpose? So one of the questions that needs to be asked in assessing the applicability of a privilege is, what is the purpose of the investigation? Is it simply to find facts? If it's just to find facts, good chance it's not going to be work product covered by work product or attorney-client privilege. Is it to find facts in anticipation of litigation? Well, if it's in anticipation of litigation, then the work product doctrine may apply, but that doesn't mean it's not discoverable. But first, we have to decide, what does anticipation of litigation mean? It means, according to the SJC, as we know, and which is fairly, you know, has been the standard for a long time, is anticipation of litigation means not just, well, I think we might get sued about this at some point, so we better cover our tracks, or let's do this and just in case we do get sued. There actually has to be a conscious intent that there's litigation coming down the track and we better get ready for it, or there is existing litigation and we need to do something about it. But it can't just be a theoretical fear that litigation might happen at some point. So in Facebook, one of the issues was how much of what was being asked for, and in that case, what was at issue was the attorney general had issued a series of document requests for several sets of information. And the question is, how much of that was gathered in anticipation of litigation? And that was a fairly easy answer for the SJC to come up with, since at the time that those requests came, Facebook was faced with multiple investigations, litigation, class action suits, and the like. So why don't I backtrack for a second just to give background to this case. What this case was came out of is the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And what that was about is that Facebook had this application or this product called the Facebook platform, and apps could make use of that platform to gather or to use data that Facebook had gathered about its millions of users. Now, there were rules that said the apps that were using the platform couldn't monetize that data. And sure enough, in this particular case, one of the apps monetized the data, sold it to Cambridge Analytica, who then turned around and used it as a basis for political mailings and targeting and the like. This became public, triggered a huge outcry, multiple class action suits and the like. The Attorney General started an investigation to see whether or not Facebook's acts had violated Chapter 93A, the consumer protection statute in Massachusetts. So it asked for, as part of its, in the course, once that scandal surfaced, Facebook conducted a massive investigation into what was going on with all of the millions of apps that were using the Facebook platform, and which apps were suspect, which apps needed further investigation, which apps needed to be kicked off the platform, and so on. And the AG in its litigation said, we want to know a series of information about the results of that in what Facebook had found out during that investigation. Like, for example, one of the requests was, give us documents sufficient to identify apps that were thought to provide, present a heightened risk of violating Facebook's rules and required further investigation, and other requests like that. So the SJC, in looking at this case, said many of these requests were not subject to the privilege because the information that the Attorney General was seeking was both factual, and the way they tailored the request was to ensure that they didn't discover or receive attorney-client communications of various forms. However, all of it was subject to the work product privilege because, come on, we're looking at, multiple ongoing litigation that was happening at the time. On the other hand, on the other extreme, if you have somebody in at work who says, I think somebody's harassed me, sexually harassed me, just because we know that's illegal doesn't mean that the investigation that follows is being done in anticipation of litigation.
Because the employee hasn't said,
I'm going to sue you. It hasn't said, I intend to sue you. The employee may just say, the employee may have no intent to sue you. So I don't think that is necessarily subject to the work product doctrine, unless, of course, it may be subject to privilege if there are communications that are conducted for the purpose of obtaining legal advice, but it may not be subject to the work product doctrine, or it may not be subject to privilege because privilege covers communications carried out for the purpose of obtaining legal advice. But what it doesn't cover is under the underlying facts. So if it's possible, for example, to discover the facts in a Facebook post that was posted that becomes part of the investigation, it might be perfectly okay to obtain the Facebook post, so long as it's possible to do it without revealing attorney-client privilege. Now, obviously, there's a whole bunch of nuance about this. Samia,
I'm chomping at the bit only to say that it's much more complicated than we think. And so I think that the part I will wholeheartedly agree with what Jim just said, is that it is a nuanced decision, and the Facebook case is required reading, as is Upjohn, the Supreme Court decision. And really, there's so many nuances to this decision that it just has to be taken thoughtfully. And so in your positions as advisors, outside advisors, in-house counsel, or people who are conducting investigations, we have to be mindful of these issues. And sometimes, you know, lots of decisions are made saying, okay, I know it's not 100% a slam dunk, but I'm going to proceed on the assumption that these communications are covered by the attorney-client privilege, and we may, and even if they are, we might decide to waive the privilege at a later date. But there's a whole bunch of nuances, and I certainly don't mean to cut you off, Jim, but I do want to make sure that you get to the practical insights on once we have decided who is conducting the investigation, whether or not it's privileged. We also have to figure out kind of what the steps are. And here's where we've got some sort of practical hacks on how to do that.